You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
One last thing, because I realized I didn't do that at the beginning, is could I just have you all introduce yourselves real quick so listeners can distinguish your voices, and I'll throw it back at the start of the episode.
My name is Courtney.
My name's also Courtney.
Whoa! I thought I was Courtney.
Oh, we're all Courtney.
Okay, seriously. I'm Sarah Rose. I'm the vocalist in the band.
I'm Susie, and I'm the violinist and screamer.
Oh, I am Courtney, and I play the viola.
I'm Keenan, and I play the guitar and some background vocals.
I'm Beth. I play keyboards and do some background vocals.
I'm Maddox. I'm fashionably late, and I play the bass.
We don't have any more members.
Oh, awesome. I was trying to... It's not a huge count.
I know that you
with the way our music sounds, like, we could literally have 50 members, honestly.
What have you been working on now?
Well, we were recording a record a few months ago in Cleveland with Jim Work. That's going to be released in the next couple of months. So that's in the works, and we have another music video that we're working on, and another single that's going to be dropping pretty soon. And we're going on tour in April to a few dates up the East Coast.
Oh, nice, nice. And I know when I was, like, you know, doing some research, reading some of the interviews that you'd done, you mentioned how Red Hot and Holy was kind of like originally a bunch of different separate singles that ended up coming together to make the album. You mentioned that you already recorded the next stuff. I'm curious how that stuff came together.
Yeah, it was very different than the Red Hot and Holy experience in a lot of different ways. So when we were recording Red Hot and Holy, we didn't really know at first that we were making an album. We were just sort of making songs and seeing where the process went. The entire album, I think, probably took us about a year to record, just because we were doing it sort of whenever we had time to hit the studio and put a song together. For this album that we just finished, that was done, really, we wrote the album within the period of a month and recorded it all within a period of about 3 weeks. So,
oh, wow.
So very different process.
Very different.
Yeah.
Yep.
And now that you're kind of, you know, through the early stages of that, how does it kind of, like, how do you feel compared to how you felt, you know, this time after Red Hot Holy was done?
You know, it's a lot closer to the first LP we ever made. Was an independent thing. It's not on the label. It was very rough and tumble in the way that we did. You know, it was live drums. It was do all the tracking for the bass in 2 days. And, you know, it was a little rougher. It was a little less polished, but it has more of a live band feel. I'd say this new record is closer to that. It's closer to Strange Doings in that spiritual way.
Yeah, definitely, that makes sense. And as a lot, like, your music and the band as a whole kind of have, like, a strong, like, theatrical feel, and I'm curious how it kind of has been for you recording on a more, like, DIY level, when it's kind of like your music kind of begs to, you know, you can't really pass it off with, like, a lo-fi bedroom recording like some artists can.
Yeah, it's we have a sort of a unique perspective, because we're certainly on a label that I think, you know, they have a lot of lo-fi sort of indie pop acts, which are awesome. I mean, we love the bands that we're label mates with. But yeah, we're a little bit interesting, because it's sort of hard. You can't really just stick us in a garage and put one mic up and hope for the best, you know, where we require a little bit more fine tuning. So, you know, I think that every album, every recording experience is sort of a lesson in how to do what we do more fluidly. Yeah. And do it in a way that goes quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, Red Hot and Holy, a lot of people don't know this, it was made in one room. So, and we made it sound pretty big, regardless.
For sure.
Yeah, and I think that in a lot of ways, like, building on what Keenan was saying, our experience doing Strange Doings in the Night, which was definitely a more, like, band in a room kind of record, we could draw from that experience with this new album and say, like, well, what lessons did we learn from Red Hot and Holy, and what lessons did we learn from Strange Doings, and how can we apply it to this experience? And I think people will see that it was kind of a unique combination of the two.
I guess kind of going to the overall feel of the band, like the kind of, you know, darker, like jazzy cabaret type feel, kind of mixed with, you know, like some of the, like the 2000s pop stuff, kind of like Panic of the Disco or the Hush Sound, okay, stuff like that. Oh, I'm curious though, like how you came to that, like the bass, like the cabaret sound and style. Was that more from like the genuine roots or from bands who are kind of like more of our generation who also found influence in those?
Well, first of all, nothing we do is genuine. So that's right out of the gate.
It's like gay frogs and birds.
Gay frogs and birds and us. That's we are next to be featured on InfoWars for sure. Real talk. I mean, honestly, a lot of my aesthetic interests and historical interests have always been with the cabaret and burlesque community. I grew up partially in New Orleans, so I was sort of always surrounded by a bunch of jazz clubs, a bunch of really sort of strange alternative burlesque and cabaret communities. That were sort of also combined with the Gulf culture and the Southern culture. So that plays into it. But I mean, also we're a band that has a lot of different diverse backgrounds. Susie can speak on that. She plays in a mariachi band.
I literally just came back from a gig, a mariachi gig. It was kind of creepy though, because it was a church thingy, but it was almost cold. Like, I don't know. But Jesus was there. Well, the founder was there. It was the founder's birthday. A lot of us really kind of personally, before we even came together, I feel like a lot of us had a love of jazz already cultivating within our own musical space. And me personally, you know, I sing it on the side. I studied it. A lot of us here have studied it as well. And it was just really interesting when we came together that our backgrounds were so different. You know, I bring a Latin background, I'm Mexican, and I'm very much about my culture. But a lot of us, although we had similarities in like what we like, we also bring so many different things to the table. And they somehow work out together. Sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
Like, remember that one time we wrote that song? It was about JFK.
Yeah, we wrote, there's some songs
that didn't work. That did not work.
There's some songs that won't.
That one did. I still stand behind that. It was brilliant. It was a dance song about the assassination of JFK. Where's the bad?
There's nothing bad.
Nothing bad in that.
That's a
B
side.
You agree with me? Scott agrees with Courtney.
America, it's time.
Yeah, it's not though.
It is not too late. Let's do it. The story.
But it's really fantastic because, you know, we all obviously love music, so we have so many different influences that we all bring to the table. I mean, for me, I've been like diving deep into Eurovision lately. I don't know why, I just sparked it. And it's amazing, you know, and I love it. And I can guarantee you that there's probably going to be some Eurovision influences coming in on whatever we write next. You know, with because of you know what I mean?
Yeah. But to your original point, we tend to go back as far back to the originals as we can,
mm-hmm. yeah.
just because those were the people who had an impact that lasted like over a century. So there's always still something new to be mined from that inspiration. There's still something to be revived, to be resuscitated. You know, I think that's where the most fertile ground tends to be.
You know, and to add to that, I mean, 30s cabaret culture was sort of, in a lot of ways, the original queer punk rock. I mean, there were so many queer voices that came out of 30s cabaret and burlesque that were prominent queer thinkers and artists and visionaries. And I think that just being a band of predominantly queer people, we would be remiss in not, you know, sort of touching on that and finding interest in that.
Yeah, I mean the like culture and everything around that seems like it would be something that's like super interesting. Like I've a lot of the like comedians that I follow kind of talk about the kind of vaudeville influence on stuff, and that stuff is so interesting. So I'm sure like all the cabaret type stuff is as well.
Yeah.
And you were kind of like mentioning a couple minutes ago about how different everyone's background is. I'm curious how you kind of all came to find each other and also how you ended up like finding a cohesive sound together.
Buckle on up, Scotty.
All right.
Here we go.
I was kidnapped.
There is just start and then it's gonna vine from there quickly.
The bassist is almost here too.
Yeah.
So
yeah. And his story is interesting too.
Oh, very.
So it's a whole everything's a whole thing.
Yeah. So so I started this band, believe it or not, as a solo project back in 2015. I had played in another band for about 10 years prior to being in this one, and I wasn't, I guess, ready to stop doing music yet, but I had no idea that it was going to explode into what this was. I really didn't have a vision for the band at that point. I just kind of knew I wanted to play music, and I needed to play live shows because I was sort of recording songs by myself. I was playing all the instruments on the original demos and just sort of figuring out what I wanted to do next, and Keenan came to me, and I had approached him about playing live with me, and he was sort of the first person to be like, well, you should make this into a band. I mean, this is something that's, you know, worth trying to pursue again. So for a while, it was just, it was me and Keenan playing together with a bassist that we knew. And that was the first sort of year or so of being in the band. And that's when we put out the Afterlife EP. It was sort of before we knew that we wanted to do like a cabaret thing. I think there are sort of shadows of it on the first EP, but not necessarily leaning in.
Yeah, no, there's shadows is a good way to describe it, because it's like it was almost there, like it's like peeking in the background of like, we want to do something with this.
Yeah.
But like you can tell it's still in its early stages, and like it kind of came, that whole like jazz vaudeville thing kind of came to fruition once more people started getting at it.
Yeah, and so we were going into doing our next LP, and we had a few people that were sort of around the band giving us, you know, the nudge that we should really pursue the sound. I had vocalized that I had always seen bands sort of do cabaret stuff in shades in other bands that I liked. I think Panic is a good example of that. Cursive, even like some bands like Fall Out Boy. I mean, stuff like that.
Pieces, but
yeah.
It was never
a whole thing. Never bits and pieces. And I had a conversation with Keenan. We had sort of had one together where, you know, we were saying, wouldn't it be great if a band really just leaned into this in a way that we had wanted to hear but hadn't heard? So that's what inspired us sort of doing Strange Doings in the Night, was I really wanted to try to explore that sound. Now, this is sort of where everyone else gets involved. So I knew Susie from KSU and Courtney from KSU. KSU is Kennesaw State University, which is the college that's sort of in the town that we grew up in. We kind of just knew from the music scene around here. And they all were session musicians on Strange Doings in the Night initially. And the first person that I asked to be in the band was Susie, who said no to me twice, by the way. Turned me down twice. And then I asked her on a third time, and she finally said yes. So then we had a violin player.
Yeah.
And we had played like one or two shows with us as a four-piece, plus a drummer. So I guess a five-piece, if you're doing math. I don't know why I said that. I'm a musician, not a mathematician.
Oh my God, I said that earlier.
Yeah. So we were playing with Susie on violin, and we were realizing, okay, yeah, this is the vibe that we need to go for. And that's sort of when the darker aesthetic kind of really became realized, this vintage-y kind of vibe we started to sort of lean into. And then I think by like the second or third show, we were already playing with Courtney and Beth anyway, as just like live musicians. And I think I had a conversation with Keenan where I was like, we really just need to bring everybody that was on the record into the band. right around that time too, we had lost our bassist, and Maddox was in a band that was around here that we all loved. We had actually played shows with this old band a few times, and we asked him sort of, at a photo shoot, actually, if he would join the band full time, and pulled him into the photos with us.
We made him play a release show.
Yeah, yeah, he played a release show on a week's notice.
Yeah, and a week's notice, he had to learn like 12 songs or whatever. Oh, and then the first rehearsal that he did with all of us is when he was rehearsing, he had just been rehearsing with Keenan. And, like, so none of us, like, had really met him, and, but, like, Keenan hadn't said anything to, like, the negative, so we were just like, I guess it's fine. Yeah. So, once it came to the first rehearsal, he was just so fucking solid the whole time.
Yeah.
And, like, nailed every single song, and we're just like, what's happening?
Wasn't his first show with us Warped Tour, though?
No.
No, it was that release show. His second show with us was Warped Tour.
Yeah, Max's second show with us was Warped
Tour. Yeah.
We learned into the fire pretty quickly.
Yeah. For but, sure. Like, after that show, we were just like, super.
Speaking of Maddox,
there's Maddox.
We were literally just talking about you.
Yeah. We were talking shit.
For the people that are listening right now, Maddox has just walked in the door wearing a Patriots jacket.
Yeah.
No. He's a piece of shit.
We can talk about that later.
But anyway, so Maddox joined. His second show was Warped Tour. And what's crazy is we've pretty much been this lineup ever since. Yeah. And, you know, I've told people before, it's kind of wild that, you know, I know bands of, like, three people that are utterly dysfunctional and everyone hates each other. But, I mean, we've been a band now in this lineup for almost 2.5 years, and we only really, kind of we only kind of hate each other.
And, like, in the loving way.
So, yeah.
You get it.
Yeah, for sure. You sound like a family the way you welcomed Maddox in. And
yeah,
it was all part of the plan.
We can kind of categorize our relationship with each other more as a family.
Yeah. I will definitely say that we're the type of band where you know we're together because we're really loud.
Yeah.
Off stage and on stage,
loud.
Always.
What?
We roll up to a Sheets on tour and we're like a hurricane.
Yeah, we're that group that the employees look out the window and they're like, oh god.
Oh no.
What are we getting into?
What is that?
Yeah. But then like we tip well and like every time we leave they're just like, oh, they were nice.
We're a little weird,
spooky, but they were cute. They were fun.
They were sweet, kind.
Yeah,
yes,
for sure.
Absolutely.
Like, you're gonna, we're gonna leave you a mess, but you're
gonna
have a smile on your face.
That was a really long answer, Scott. Sorry.
Oh yeah, no worries. Love to hear it. And kind of that last little tangent about like being able to tell that you're in a group together. I feel like that kind of speaks to the fact that the band has created such like a solid aesthetic. I'm curious how that kind of like aspect of it came about.
You know, I think that part of it was by accident and part of it was, you know, sort of figuring it out as we went along. We're all kind of nerds. So that adds to the benefit of us kind of having an idea for visuals. I mean, I've always been fascinated by old aesthetics and 20s, 30s aesthetics and dark and spooky stuff. I mean, because who doesn't love dark and spooky stuff? It's like so fun.
Yeah,
it's so fun to dress in that kind of stuff. And you know, I read an interview once with Jack White of the White Stripes, and he said, you know, he really missed the era when rock bands would dress up for shows.
And
make it like they were putting on sort of armor to go into things. They would wear suits, or you know, it would be over the top. And that's not to disparage bands that don't do that.
I
totally am not knocking that, but I think that there is something to be said about, you know, when you go up on stage and you see a band that looks cohesively like they're all on the same page, it makes you feel like you're part of a show, you know?
And
it also, I think, helps you as a performer too, because
it's
a physical act of sort of transforming yourself
to
become, you know, like a stage persona. And I've always really appreciated
what
it does for me as a vocalist, because when I get up there, I'm not, you know, I don't wear a corset and, you know, a 20s wear, 30s wear, and a full face of makeup every day. So
she said not every day.
Not every day. I have a little extra. So you know, it creates, I think for all of us, you know, when we're changing, even if it's a pain in the ass sometimes, especially when we're on tour, to change into our stage clothes.
For sure.
It creates such a unique experience, I think, for us and for the audience to see us come on stage. Yeah.
It's just like, we're here, and here's what we are going to do. Yeah. We're going to be weird, and we're going to be loud, and we're going to be spooky, and weird in love with us.
Yes, we're here, we're queer, we're trying ourselves out.
We're sticky.
Yeah, right.
Oh no, why does that fit so well?
But I really love what you said, Sarah, because I mean, for me personally, I feel like a lot of people, when they see me and Courtney on stage, and you know, we have a string instrument in our hand, they think, oh, it's gonna be really beautiful. And we're both like headbanging, like basically almost doing splits.
People are very confused.
I'm screaming into a microphone, but whenever before the show starts, that process of like, you know, putting on our clothes, putting our makeup on, it really just helps transform it. And to me, it just amplifies the show tenfold. Like we got the chance to open up for Motionless in White. And their whole stage aesthetic and their whole appearance was just kind of like, oh my gosh, that's what we want to do.
Yeah.
Because it just, makes you, it's not just a concert. It becomes, I know this is like, ooh, hippie, but it becomes an experience.
Yeah. All my favorite bands are ones that have really cool stage shows. I mean,
sure.
I've, little known fact, I've been to 9 Slipknot concerts in my life.
Hell yeah.
And I love, my parents love Kiss. Yeah, and I love
Guar is still one Guar of the best shows amazing. I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Guar, Lordy.
Musically and visually.
And then, I was a nerd when I was a kid, so I grew up on a lot of Visual K, too. So I love, like, bands
same
like Deer and Gray, Malice Mizer, Versailles. So all those bands, I mean, when I watch their stage shows, I that was such an inspiration for how I wanted to play music.
Yeah, I definitely know what you mean about, like, the difference between, like, a concert and a show. Like, I think it was like last year, 2 years ago, Andrew McMahon did like, it was like an evening with Andrew McMahon, and he had like a set, and it was like, he was like Mr. Rogers. He sang the theme song at the beginning and took off his jacket and like had his friends popping by and stuff. And it was like, you know, a really cool, like special experience. And I'm curious, like how, like where is, as far as like your aspirations for like a stage show, like where are you now versus where is like your pie in the sky dream of like what you could do on stage?
I mean, you do not want to give us a budget because we would go crazy
yep,
with it.
But I was just about to say we need to win the lottery because our aspirations and dreams can never have a cap on it because we will just
Somehow we're just going to come up with something more ridiculous.
Well, just think Flaming Lips, but a badass.
Like the grand piano coming down out of the
ceiling.
But it's all of us coming down in our own grand piano.
I want a grand piano.
Just 6 grand pianos and all of us laying down on six.
I'm the only one playing.
Scott, let me ask you a question. Have you watched the Taylor Swift Reputation tour documentary?
No, I haven't.
Okay, I need you to watch that because her stage show is insane.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Oh, yeah.
And I was the whole time I watched it in bed, drunk and and not stoned at 2 o'clock in the morning. Just being like, I want to do that. I want snakes coming out of the ceiling. So like,
I'm down with snakes.
Yes, so, all the snakes.
I mean, I think that right now, you know, for what we are, I mean, obviously we tour and we're usually openers on tour. So, you know, there's limited capacity for what we can do on a stage. But I think if we ever had a chance to do, I mean, honestly, if you couldn't give us enough money to do a stage show. I read a story once actually about Lady Gaga and how she would spend her own personal income on her first few tours on her stage show because that was what she loved to do, was to make her stage show amazing. And I totally sympathize with that. I think all of us, we love putting a lot into our stage show, and I think we would probably do the same under the same.
Yeah, I mean, you just saying that reminds me of her paparazzi performance.
Yeah.
Was it at the VMAs? Mm-hmm. Was it? Yeah. Like that whole stage show was just absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact that if we were given the opportunity, we would definitely go all out. Now, granted, because we are openers, like Sarah said, we can't do much, but we are in the works of finding ways to how we can amp it up.
Yeah.
Currently,
And we always, I mean, I think that if you talk to anyone that comes to our show, they know that it's not a typical rock show. I mean, it's crazy. And like, we really try, we take a lot of inspiration from bands like Guar and Lordy and Slipknot and all those bands that put on a show, and we want to do the same with ours. So
yeah,
our vibe is that if we're opening for a show, we want to be talked about as much as the band that you came to see.
Yeah.
So. For sure.
Show a little bit. Just a little bit. Or a lot.
Yeah. If you haven't picked up Scott, we're all kind of divas. So.
But you don't let them find that out until you, after you play.
Yeah.
So I also kind of wanted to, I feel like something that's very prevalent in the music is kind of like a dark humor, definitely in like Ralph Scott's No Soda, when they're like, I knew a sad man told me to keep my chin up, told me to smile more, so I took his teeth. I'm curious if you could just like kind of tell me a little bit about that and how that came to be part of the band.
Everyone in the band is staring at me right now.
So there's a thing in this band that we kind of had this sort of a comment when we would work on stuff. We would say, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to go up to the line, probably cross the line, and then we're going to determine if we just need to draw a new line where we are.
Yeah.
Because a lot of bands just, we felt in maybe the local scene, not going to, you know, name any names or anything, but like just a lot of acts seem to always be just fall shy, just short of where we feel like they should be.
Yeah.
You know, like they're giving it the full 80%. And come up with lines like that, it's basically us just shouting out things that are like, well, this would be ridiculous. This seems over the top. This seems intense. And then we determine, but is it good?
I think every band has a moment, whether it's in their live show or in the studio, where you have a moment where you're like, should we do that? Like, wouldn't it be crazy if we did that? And a lot of bands, you know, I think that they kind of have a moment with their internal voice where they're like, we can't do that. That's crazy. Yeah. And I think it's like Keenan said, it's about finding that line of like, which moments do you take where you go, yeah, let's do that, you know, and see what happens. And I think that's when you get the moments like me taking someone's teeth or, you know, us doing weird shticks on stage. Just we find those pockets where we can really dig into the humor, and it's some of my favorite stuff that we do in the band.
We try to say yes more often than we say no.
I mean, we do say no, but
like for example, there was a line, a couple line, it was a verse, I forgot what song it was.
Wasn't it All Scott's the second verse?
I think it was.
There's that was different than what
it was.
That was the one that's coming out.
There's some songs, there are moments, Scott, where we had to dial it back because it's a little crazy. So like it doesn't always work, but more often than not, we sort of find the humor in good ways. The thing is that like even if we're on tour and we're exhausted, we can usually get on stage and play a show and laugh at what we're doing and that's the whole thing, is we have a lot of fun laughing at our own humor. So
awesome. Yeah, and I guess as far as like you mentioned earlier, the kind of dichotomy between like your stage self and your like off stage and like your personal self, and then you also just kind of like mentioned the idea of like, you know, not fully taking yourself seriously on stage and stuff. I'm curious how I don't know, I guess I feel like so many of the bands that I listen to, they don't have that separation, so I'm curious how how that separation kind of like came into being.
I think, well, for, I can only speak for myself, but I think that I don't take myself very seriously. And I really, one of my biggest pet peeves are people who do.
Yep.
You know, I think that you have to be able to laugh at yourself. And I mean, the music industry is so silly to begin with, you know? I mean, we're a bunch of nerds that get up on stage and make sounds in front of people. Yeah. You know, and I think that I'm not to name names, but I think that we've played with so many bands that, you know, they act like they're saving the world when they show up at a venue and they take themselves so seriously.
God.
And I think music is great. I mean, it's transformative. It helps people get through situations and things like that. And that's not to discount anything that people take away from music. But I also think that there's part of, you know, laughing at the theater of it all. Yeah. You have to.
I mean, coming from a classical background, like nothing that anybody does with music nowadays is going to be groundbreaking because you just can't be. So why take it so seriously when you just have fun and make dumb songs with your friends and then like see what happens? Because like there's too many things happening in anybody's life or in the world where you should take something that is like can be so much fun and make it so serious. Like music is fun. Music should be fun. Like, of course, music has stuff to say, like, artists who have things to say, like, please go and say them. We're not necessarily that band, but we're still going to have something to say where you're going to be like, oh, what's that mean? Or like, yeah. Let me listen to that again because like, I'm not sure, like that was a cool line or like that was, yeah. You know? So like we're going to have little bits of like brilliance where we want it to be, but we're not going to be like, this is the most amazing music that has ever been made. Because like, I mean, not Beethoven. We're not Beethoven.
Yeah.
No. Beethoven was Beethoven.
Okay.
That's why I said Beethoven. He was still pretty fucking metal while he was alive.
Yeah, yep, that is very true.
And he was always that bitch. So,
you yourself said you were a fan of like comedians going back that far around like vaudeville and all that. It's kind of this thing with like modern day comedians. I mean, once you get up to stuff like Lenny Bruce and all that, they may have had serious things to say, they had serious political commentary. But it always goes down easier with a joke anyway. Like you can't take yourself so seriously because if you put yourself in the proper historical context, it's impossible to take yourself seriously. So don't. You say it gives the important things you say more importance if it comes in the fact of you being relaxed with yourself and more aware.
And I think, you know, my experience is that when I come on stage, whether or not we want to acknowledge it or not, I am an open trans person that has a microphone that's a lead singer of a band. There's only, you know, so many people in the music industry that do that. So my way of disarming audiences is to, you know,
entertain them
and laugh a little bit. You know, that's the last thing people are expecting from me. And I feel like once we do that, you know, people are sort of know they can relax and chill out.
Yeah. And
know that it's a safe space for everybody, you know, and that's important to us.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm curious, we like mentioned a little bit earlier about kind of like your label mates on Take This to Heart. And I'm curious kind of like how does more of your fan base come from like that kind of like DIY punk world or from like somewhere else musically? And how do if both sides of those exist within the fan base, how do they kind of like approach when they come to your show differently?
Well, first, you know, we can say as a band that there is no better home than Take This to Heart. I mean, we have such a respect for our label mates and we love the audience that they've, you know, it's sort of, we've been brought into a whole nother family through signing with them, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
They have their own, you know, sort of followers, and we've seen that sort of in our social media and in playing shows, you know. And why wouldn't there be? I mean, you got bands like Bad Luck, Jetty Bones. I mean, really cool people that sort of have cultivated their own audience. And we're so lucky that we've gotten to be introduced to them as well. Because I mean, I would say, being honest, you know, we don't come from a DIY punk world necessarily. I mean, even when the band started, we weren't playing really basement shows or anything like that. Man, we're lucky that we get to be, you know, introduced to a kid that might like Bad Luck and has never heard a band like ours before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the same token, I mean, I think that, you know, just being who we are and the band that we are, before we even signed to Take This to Heart, we were, you know, had queer kids that were listening to our band, really artistic, sort of nerdy kids that I think appreciated sort of the aesthetic that we were doing and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think that just being an Atlanta band where there's all kinds of different communities that kind of cohabitate the same space.
Yeah.
We have different audiences from different places, and that's sort of always been the case, you know? And I think signing to Take This to Heart has only kind of grown that weird, diverse audience. We love it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. That makes a lot of sense. And then I kind of wanted to, I feel like the songs that kind of like stood out the most to me, would be as like, you know, as stand out within the discography as just kind of like interesting for various reasons. I think like Dead Girls Tell No Tales, Formula 666, and Dig a Fancy Grave. I'm curious if you could like choose one of those and just kind of like let me know like the story behind like how they kind of came together and also like the diverse sounds within them especially.
Well, okay, so Dig a Fancy Grave has a really interesting story behind it.
Oh, yeah,
it does. Okay. Actually.
So when, like Sarah was saying, when we got together with Susie, we kind of like, you know, jammed out on the sound a little bit, and we were thinking of where we could go with that. And one of those sounds, really briefly, just kind of entertained the idea, was doing some sort of very Eastern European sounding, you know, like Fiddler on the Roof Oompa Oompa kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we threw together this demo and had no idea. I had no idea what it was going to be. We just threw it together. It was actually in the same writing session that we came up with the Louisville Shuffle.
Yeah.
But instead of Louisville, where we worked on it immediately, we kind of shelved the riff that would eventually be the main verse to Dig Your Fancy Grave for about a year and a half, maybe.
Yeah, it kind of loomed over us. Like, we all knew it was cool, but we didn't really know what to do with it.
Yeah. We kept like diving into it randomly in practice. We would just start playing it.
We knew we liked it. What
now?
Yeah. Yeah, and then eventually, I forget really what made it click, but. Ooh. Oh, do you remember? Okay.
Yeah, so once we like really solidified Louisville, mm-hmm. We really then kind of took that sound because of the string parts. Mm-hmm. It was very klezmer. That it was very like leaning towards klezmer.
It's a little klezmer.
And that's when like we started really kind of like, okay, if we could do this Louisville, how can we make this work for Dig a Fancy Grave? And I feel like after we did that, that's when it, like the pieces started to fall together for it.
Yeah. And then we stitched it together with just a full-on rock chorus because it's, right? It's wide open. And then, but I think the la 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 la's were like, that was like one of those ideas where we came up with it and we were like, yeah, we're okay, we got to do this.
There were some weird moments in it because I think there was like a moment between me and Keenan where we got to the bridge and we were like, yeah, this has to have like a carnival barker on it, right? And like, it was like the same thing.
And little sound effects.
So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of wild. Yeah, the sound effects, like, we both were on the same page with that. And so,
you'll notice there's an elephant in there.
There's an elephant in there. So.
And I mean, and that goes back to what we were saying earlier. We don't take ourselves seriously.
Yeah.
So, I literally remember when we were recording this in the tiny room that we did, our producer, Aaron, who was recording us, he said, make it nasty. And me and Courtney were just like, la, 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 la. Like, we're like, we were like, you want nasty, we got it. And as soon as he suggested that as a joke, and then as soon as we did that, we went, oh, that has to be it.
We were like, yeah. And he just goes,
okay,
he does a lot.
Yeah,
he does a lot. He begrudgingly sighs, and it ends up being good. We're just like, just trust us. We're gonna make a lot of weird noises, and then he does.
So much of it is sort of this weird, just synthesis that all of us have sometimes, where we can all be thinking about something, and it becomes like you mentioned Formula 666. Like, I think Keenan sent me the riff to that song. And I messaged him, this sounds like a demon drag racing song. And he responded, Formula 666. And I was like, So, like, we just kind of, like, both were on the same page with the direction to take it. And I was living in San Francisco at the time briefly for my job. And Keenan and Beth came out to hang out with me for a little bit. And I remember... it was either before or after we had been out in the city for a while, but we had ended up back in my apartment.
It was after.
And we literally wrote the lyrics to the song pretty much in 30 minutes.
Yep.
Okay. And we had gotten to the bridge with the dialogue and we had laughed about that. We were laughing about it for like the next 5 hours because we both got to the first speed. And we probably said that like 400 times over the next 5 hours.
We were walking
around San Francisco at like maybe 11 o'clock at night, just doing this dialogue part over and over again. So we found it so funny. And we were like, we have to. And that's kind of, that's how it all kind of happens. Like we write things and we usually know it's going to be a song if like me and Keenan like are sort of on the same page of like finding something equally hilarious. So yeah.
That's awesome. I love how kind of like spur of the moment it sounds like a lot of that stuff comes together for you.
Yeah, it's spooky sometimes. There's some songs that are on the new album that me and Keenan and then the rest of the band, but like we all wrote sort of within the last maybe like 48 hours before we ended up going up to Cleveland, and they're some of my favorite songs. So
Beth and I were in another room writing our parts to some song, and they came down and like started playing it, and it was just like, yeah, that's going on the record 100%. Yeah. And they had written it like half an hour was just like boom, there it is.
Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, and sometimes a lot of it also happens in the middle of us recording.
Yeah.
And, like for example, I remember one medley, we were like one line for the violin we were doing, and I messed it up, but it sounded better when I messed it up. So we went with that direction. So it's a lot of spur in the moments, but I feel like us as people, we're kind of like that. Like we toured one time and we stopped in Lake Park, Georgia. And we just randomly came up with a little jingle for Lake Park. We literally sang it for like 30 million hours.
Yeah, we, for people who don't know, Lake Park is not a city of many people or many things, but they were very nice there.
People or things.
But we wrote like we probably have a whole album ready to record about songs about Lake Park that we wrote in our Motel 6 motel room that night.
Yep.
So basically, Scott, what we're saying is that we're all crazy.
Well, I was just like pondering this. Like I just thought like we all have like full-time jobs where like we're all doing like big kid thing, like big people things. So like the last thing we want to do is we're like, let's make serious music. Like fuck that. I had such a hard Monday. You had a hard Monday. Let's write a stupid song. We need to put that to something, and we just put that energy towards music. And
let's write a song about pirates.
Why? Yeah. That we don't like to play live, that we have to play live now.
And it's not that we don't like the song. It's just
a hard song. Yeah, we wrote a hard song for ourselves.
Yeah. Scott, you have a scoop right now, Scott. We hate playing Dead to Slide. Yeah. Play it, because if we try not to, kids will yell in the audience.
Yeah,
so,
we have to play it. We love the song. I don't hate the song. I love it. Like, this is a great song. Yeah, and then playing it, I'm like, why did we do this?
I listen to it, I'm like, this is so beautiful. And then we get to it in rehearsal, and I'm like,
we're like,
why the
fuck
did we write this?
Yeah.
This is awful.
I'm the only person in the band that actually
loves
playing that song. I'm always like, yes.
Oh,
yes.
Same here.
You're
no, yeah, Susie
me.
And Maddox.
I always, like,
yeah, me and Ben are like, no, right? Yeah. No, right? No.
But also, too, Scott, this kind of touches on a question that you asked earlier. A lot of our songs are heavily layered in the studio, and there's so many things I go to it. When it comes to Dead Girls, that song, I think at one point the computer crashed because
of it. Did.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, no, it crashed.
This one means a lot to people who aren't familiar with like Pro Tools, but that session has 307 tracks in it.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
And here's the thing, Scott. The reason why it only has 300 was because we couldn't do more than 300.
Yeah.
We were gonna do a lot more.
At one point, he put a fan on his PC because it was overheating.
So much. Oh my gosh.
We're not doing at all. But there's a thousand of us. Yeah. We want to have all the layers. we want to have a huge stage show. What's wrong with us? Why do we need so
harmonies.
Much? Yeah. Everybody sing all at once. That's fine.
Yeah, definitely doable in the live show. And I like to kind of wrap up by just asking for either like a piece of advice or like something you've been mulling over lately that you'd like to share, either about like music or just like life in general.
Sure. Well, asking us for advice is a terrible
idea.
That
was terrible. That was not good. Yeah. Here we go.
My biggest advice is that if your play coordinator has already fumbled one Super Bowl, maybe don't. Don't hire him to your other team who's been playing in the Super Bowl. Probably blow a lead for a second time. Beyond that,
all right. Listen very carefully, Scott. A lot of people mess this up. Okay, you have to put the lime in.
Then you drink it.
Yeah. My biggest advice is that if anyone's going to buy Pony Play gear, they should probably buy it from Recon and not Mr. S, because they make their bits out of a more biteable material.
Or wish.com. I think personally for me, I'm gonna make a sappy. I'm just kidding. No, but I feel like the biggest question that I've gotten a lot after shows is from people asking me like, how did you get into a band? How did you even like find this avenue? Because I do so much just not only like being part of this amazing band, but like outside of it. And I think the biggest piece of advice that I've been giving to a lot of people and to my students as well, me and Courtney are high school teachers. Well, she's a middle school teacher. I'm currently teaching out of high school.
Pray for me.
Yeah. Pray for Courtney. But also, just do it. Life is too short to ponder and ask, what would happen if I, you know, picked up a camera one day, maybe wanted to venture into photography, or I kind of want to learn this instrument. Just fucking do it. Like, life is too short to not seek out your dreams and not go for them full force.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, I think one thing that bands always talk to me about is they ask me for advice on what to do and everything like that, or, you know, what steps they should take to move their band forward. Be open to advice if you're a young musician.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
You know, there's a lot of feedback out there, and I think that it's a trapping of a young musician a lot of the time to be very apprehensive or be very sensitive about the criticism or feedback or advice that they get. I get that because I've been there too. I was in a band at one point and didn't want to listen to anyone tell me that I sucked, but I think that if you're willing to listen to people that are trying to give you good moves and good advice on steps to take in the industry, it comes from a place of genuinely wanting to help out.
Yeah.
And I would just say, like, if you're a young musician, you know, listen to that stuff, because a lot of the times, you know, people are right. Trust your gut. But, you know, the best way you can get forward in any industry is to learn from the people that have sort of been there before you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
People in bands have this, you know, they read these stories or they see these things in movies where, like, the band is doing what they want to do and the, you know, greasy, slick back hair manager is like, well, I think you should do this. And they're like, fuck you, man. We're going to do our own thing. It's like, that's cool, I guess, if that guy's weird. But, like, when it's your when it's telling you things, or people who have, people that you're close with who have achieved things that you would like to achieve, like, no, listen. The deal is that a lot of bands who have gotten to where they are today, bigger bands, have made a lot of compromise decisions. And I know that's a nasty word, but, like, it's a really important way of achieving success is listening to advice, compromising on what you may think you want to do, and then just forging a new path from there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to, like, the kind of roll with it nature of the band that we were kind of talking about before. And my quizzical nature has to have me ask what was either, like, the most recent or best advice that you've gotten via that method.
Oh, man.
Don't let anyone tell you shit. I'm just kidding.
That's the end of the thing. I mean, that's something that we all had to learn.
Yeah. I think in this band, you know, we in spite of being six really eccentric personalities that have a lot of opinions about art, we have always, you know, especially when the band first started, we took a lot of advice from peers in the industry about directions to take the band, stuff that we didn't necessarily always feel comfortable with, but I'm really glad that we took their advice, because, you know, I think that we would be in a much different place now if we hadn't have listened to outside feedback. I mean, we have our producer, Aaron Pace, who worked on Red Hot and Holy. I mean, his external perspective on our band has helped us out in so many different ways, because he has helped us edit songs, look at songs in different dimensions. And I think that's really valuable when you can sort of bring in people that you trust to sort of give you feedback and square it to you straight when they might not necessarily be the most kind thing they could say, but the most real thing that they could say.
Build a team, and if I could quote the 1975, friends don't lie. That's the thing. You got to understand that, like, that is an incredibly important part, is the trust.
Learn to take criticism from people that you know genuinely love you, but also learn to kind of keep yourself in check too. You know, a lot of the times, sometimes we can, you know, if I'm having a bad day or something and I say something to a friend and it kind of comes off in the wrong way, well, I know, well, I didn't mean it like that, you know. And also too, like, good friends will stick up for you. Good friends want you to succeed. Mm-hmm. They don't want you to flounder. So if you surround yourself with really great, loving people, they will help you boost yourself up while you do the same for them. It's a two-way road.
Yeah.
Definitely push you out of your comfort zone and to do things that you maybe would not be comfortable with at first, but sometimes you just got to do that stuff and you got to just keep working at it and listen to the people around you.
Yeah.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today, such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.